ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Sonia Faruqi, author of Project Animal Farm. That's a little later in the show, but first some news. From China Daily, Chinese customs have seized around $483 million worth of smuggled meat, some more than 40 years old and rotting, the latest in a grim series of food safety scares. Beijing toughened food safety laws in April to shake off a reputation for safety scandals that range from donkey meat tainted with fox DNA to milk contaminated with industrial chemical melamine that killed at least six infants in 2008. Chinese authorities have launched a crackdown on beef and frozen meat smuggling, in addition to a campaign last year to stamp out the smuggling of farm products. Authorities had busted 21 criminal gangs by June, leading to seizures of more than 100,000 tons of smuggled meat, including chicken wings, beef, and pork. In one bust, customs officials found some of the meat was more than 40 years old, meaning it dated back to the 1970s. Other parts were rotten and decomposing, the China Daily newspaper said. It was not clear if the seized meat had been destroyed. Industry sources say hundreds of thousands of tons of beef is being smuggled into China via neighboring Hong Kong and Vietnam, from countries such as Brazil and India, to sidestep Beijing's import curbs.
A new law in Mexico banning the use of tigers, elephants, zebras, lions, and other exotic animals in circuses comes into effect this week. The law, which was approved last March, is aimed at preventing animal cruelty, and those who violate it will face fines of $250,000. Over 3,000 circus animals will be freed from performing under the big top thanks to this law. The question remains, however, what will happen to all these animals? For many circus owners, the animals will be too expensive to keep. One Mexican animal tamer estimated that it cost around 3,000 pesos, which is almost $200, a day to feed circus tigers. When you add other costs like vet bills on top of that, keeping wild animals is very costly. An official from the Mexican Environmental Protection Agency said the government is evaluating different facilities that could take in these animals. Privately owned zoos have also offered to house them. Some circus owners claim that the new law, designed to protect circus animals, is actually putting the animals in worse danger. Some exotic animal owners are trying to sell them, and others plan to euthanize them. The Associated Press reported last week that Mexican authorities had found six tigers, seven baboons, and four camels abandoned in cages. They had been left without food or water. Mexico is the 29th country to pass a nationwide ban on circus animals. The United States has full or partial bans on circus animals in only 22 states.
From one green planet, polar bears have become the canary in the coal mine for the emerging problem of climate change. And while a changing climate threatens a variety of plant and animal species worldwide, it is the iconic face of the polar bear that has come to symbolize the plight of nature in the face of a damaged environment. An estimated 8.6 million acres of the polar bear's native habitat disappear a year due to the rapidly warming temperature of the planet. While there are many different factors at play at the loss of this ancient ice, greenhouse gas emissions associated with animal agriculture have been shown to play a major role in the loss of the polar bear's home, which is putting this species in dire straits. Polar bears rely on the ice to live and hunt for food. As we quickly melt away this habitat due to our greenhouse gas-heavy diets, bears are being forced to sustain themselves in rather unusual ways. Scientists have recently documented some shocking behavior exhibited by polar bears in Norway over the last year. Several polar bears were seen consuming dolphins, an animal not typical in the bear's diet. In total, scientists spotted six different polar bears feeding on the carcasses of white-beaked dolphins, and it appeared that the polar bears caught their prey when the dolphins surfaced in a hole in the ice pack and were then hauled out of the water by a hungry bear, just as they do with seals. In addition to these discoveries of a prey source for polar bears, scientists also noted a behavior that is not necessarily unheard of, but is still rare. Some of the polar bears had packed leftovers from their meals into the ice in an apparent effort to save it for later, possibly a sign of concerns over food shortages for the bears. Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with author Sonia Faruqi. Her first book, Project Animal Farm, An Accidental Journey into the Secret World of Farming and the Truth About Our Food, will be released this week. Sonia is a graduate of Dartmouth College and worked on Wall Street before a volunteer vacation at a dairy farm turned into the beginning of a global expedition into the deepest, darkest recesses of the animal agriculture industry. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Sonia Faruqi. Thanks for being with us, Sonia.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Sonia, if you'd tell us what inspired you to write your book, Project Animal Farm. Can you tell us what inspired you?
Yeah, so Project Animal Farm traces my journey investigating animal farms around the world toward the aim of improving the lives of farm animals. It started accidentally for me when I volunteered at an organic dairy farm, expecting it to be very pastoral and picturesque, and finding that it was quite the opposite and animals were not treated well. That started me on the trek to learning more about the problems and to discovering solutions to these problems.
Based on what I've read, you went to Dartmouth College, worked on Wall Street. And
yep.
then your vacation idea was to go to a dairy farm. Did you have a love for animals before this time or an interest in animal issues before that?
So I didn't to a very serious extent. I've never had a pet, not a cat or a dog, but I've been sympathetic to animals, even if from a distance.
Uh-huh.
So I've had a soft spot for animals. That said, not a specific animal as such, but just animals in general.
Right. That's interesting. Most people have an early connection, but that's great that you discovered it a little bit deeper and later in life. So what happened after the dairy farm? What did you do at that point?
So in Project Animal Farm, after I meet the dairy farmer at his birthday party, where I sort of have to go there, I meet another farmer called Brick Roberts, who's an egg factory farmer. And we really hit it off, and then later on I go and live with him in his house. And through him, I get immersed in this community of factory farmers, contract growers, and I start visiting their farms and investigating, and I become very interested in this topic. And I start to realize that this is so important, it's so vital, and yet very few people have inside access in the way that I was able to obtain.
Right.
And so I decided to keep moving forward and to write about it in Project Animal Farm.
You've been to different farms all around the world. Did you find much of a difference between the farms in Mexico and Canada in the United States? Was there a big difference? Are they treated better in some other countries?
So I went to lots of countries in North America, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. It's more or less very similar, the same sorts of breeds and setups and concepts are being applied. But there are differences when we look internationally. For instance, Belize is a country where farming is largely pastoral, and it's done mostly by Mennonites in a very sort of traditional way, and animals are viewed not as objects but as beings, and they have names. So that was very interesting to see, and it offers us a different mindset and a potential solution that this country has pretty much most of its farming done like this, and it's working. And I also went to Indonesia, which is in a state of transition. Most of the farming previously was village backyard flocks, and now it's shifting, like most places in the world, to factory farming. So that transition is fascinating and also scary to observe. Countries assume that, oh, the U.S. has the system of massive factory farms. This has to be good. It has to be a part of development. We need to imitate this,
right,
which is a harmful mindset in the long term. It's harmful for animals and people and the planet as well. And I'm hoping that Project Animal Farm helps to sort of contradict that shift.
You know, speaking of harm to animals and harm to humans, I mean, for so many of us who really haven't spent any time in factory farms because they're tucked away and hidden off side roads in the middle of nowhere, you know, can you tell us a little bit about what your experience was inside some of the factory farms?
Sure. In Chapter 2 of Project Animal Farm, where I am at this egg factory farm, it's a startling experience. The first thing I tend to notice at factory farms, and the first thing that strikes most people, I think, is the smell. It's just so many animals and so much manure that you start to feel a little sick, and like I started coughing and sneezing, and tears were streaming out of my eyes, not for emotional reasons as such, but just the biological smell of it really starts to affect your body. And the animals, so the hens in this place were stacked up 4 levels to the ceiling, higher than my head. And there's 3 aisles or 3 columns of cages going far down. And it's sad to see that hens are, like most birds, very active creatures. They like to move, they like to walk, they like to spread their wings. And they have so many natural behaviors that are completely impossible in these tiny wire cages. So it was interesting to see how the place ran and also how contradictory it was to animal nature. For instance, if a hen doesn't like another hen, then she does what a person would do. She would move away from that other hen. But in a cage, that's not possible. And so they're pecking each other, and these behaviors start that can spread throughout the factory farm. But instead of taking the animals out of the cages, what the industry does is it lowers the lights, it debeaks the hens, it puts walls between the cages so they can't see into other cages. So it was very interesting to see how such an unnatural system was running.
Right.
You know, I believe a lot more people are aware of the terrible conditions of factory farms, but they've tried to move towards humane meat and free range and all these other terms, which makes them feel better about what they're eating. But what is your experience with organic and free range? Do you find that to be a scam?
So organic and free range today need to be a lot more regulated. For instance, organic today says that animals need to be out for 120 days of the year. It doesn't specify how long on those days, it does, and 120 days of the year is only 1 out of 3 days. So the other 2 out of 3 days, they can be crammed together, and it's still called organic. And this is not the case in all countries. So organic really needs to be stronger. It needs to be tighter. And if it is, then it can actually show a significant difference between the factory farm and the organic farm. Free range is even a lot less regulated than organic. Very little is specified, like how many days of outdoor access, what kind of access, how much access. And so it's it can often be a scam because there's just no way to know what's truly free range and what's not.
I think about, you know, we see in the news almost every week or 2 weeks, there's a new investigation that comes out, excuse me, about a various factory farm and the abuse that goes on and the lack of oversight. And the industry tries to say, oh, these are isolated incidents. But unfortunately, it just the incidents just keep happening. So they're really not isolated. And I think about for so many of the investigators, they go in and they don't really know the families or they don't know the people that own the businesses or the farms. But your situation was different. You in some of these farms, you were actually living with them. And I'm curious as to your experiences with the farmers and how they felt about, you know, the way that they were raising their animals.
I enjoyed my experiences living with farmers. It gave me a very three-dimensional look at everything and to have a sort of inside access and inside perspective. So I found that farmers today are often very conflicted about what they're doing. They don't necessarily like it. Some of them don't want to enter their own factory farms. One of the farmers, for instance, was asthmatic. He has asthma and he can literally die in his chicken factory farm because of how bad the smell is and all the gases swirling in there.
Jeez.
So I did find often even unhappiness that farmers had with their own operations. They didn't want to go in them. And the reason these farms exist is because today the industry is under the mistaken perception that you have to farm this way. This is the only way to do it, which it actually is not. There can be a lot of changes made that would make these factory farms or make these farms a lot better for animals and people both. So I found that the mindset was often mixed and sometimes confusing and contradictory as well.
You know, from what I've read in the past, it seems like most farmers, including the large operations, are just barely breaking even. And if they weren't supported by government subsidies, they wouldn't be able to make a profit at all. And it seems like, you know, we can't move to a more humane system because it's even more expensive. What are your feelings about that?
One of the solutions I propose in Project Animal Farm is something that I saw in the United States and Canada. It's the concept of large pastoral. So factory farms today can be classified as large industrial, and they're large industrial facilities. The concept of large pastoral still keeps the idea of scale, but instead of the animals being indoors in this sort of horrible dark shed, they're outside on the grass, they're moving, they have happy lives, and at the same time, there are economies of scale that help reduce costs and reduce prices to consumers. So the farms I've seen of this kind, this is a very new concept that I hope catches on because large pastoral is just so many times better than large industrial and while keeping a lot of the cost and price structures quite similar.
I mean, unfortunately, I guess any way the animals are raised, the fate is all the same. And I think, too, about some of the slaughterhouse workers and what their experiences are like. Did you have many interactions with them in the course of your research?
I did. I spent a day at a slaughter plant. That's in Chapter 8 of Project Animal Farm, and I came to know a worker there. Workers at slaughter plants often have very little training, very little education, and they're at high risk for injury and even potentially death. So that's commonly the case, and that's something that needs to change. Farms and slaughter plants both need to be much more regulated, and they need to have proper inspections. That these sorts of changes are easy and actually make very significant differences in animal welfare and also human welfare.
So what are your plans for the future? Are you going to write another book on this topic?
My goal at the moment is to raise awareness about the conditions of farm animals and the changes that can easily be made, both by changing consumption habits and by changing production practices. That's what I'm working on at the moment.
That's great. I think people consume a lot more meat than they really need anymore, and it'd be nice if we could reduce consumption.
Absolutely. That's a huge part of the solution, and that's something that each person can himself or herself do very easily. I mean, the average meat consumption in the U.S. is about 170 pounds a year, not including fish, not including eggs or milk or cheese or ice cream or any of these products. So reducing that would be very, very helpful, whether reducing slightly or significantly.
Yeah, you know, you talked a little bit about regulation and oversight, and we're making these facilities where animals grow faster and faster, and then we're taking them to slaughterhouses where they're killed faster, and they're trying to increase speed lines and decrease oversight. How has your experience been internationally in terms of government oversight? Do you get the sense that, you know, other governments really take food safety and the animal's welfare into perspective?
Some places do. Europe does, for instance. So in Europe, legally, animal welfare is on an equal footing with healthcare, gender equality, education, and other important societal principles. In the U.S. and Canada, there has been some state legislation that's been helpful in those states. But at this stage, there hasn't been any sort of national-level regulation. And on the contrary, there has been state regulation as well, like ag-gag laws, which make things worse and more challenging. So regulation really does vary nationally and internationally, and it's a very important part of change. It sets the tone for what's acceptable and what's not, and it sets penalties in place as well. And I'm hoping that we do reach a stage in society where harming an animal is punishable as it should be.
Well, you know, I was thinking about meat consumption in terms of, you know, if in an ideal world for some, if we move to more of this pastoral relationship in society and economy, how that relates to the environment. And, you know, raising animals for food is just requires so many more resources than just raising plant-based foods. How do you get this? Do you get the sense that other countries are taking the idea of climate change and the way that animal agribusiness affects it? Do you get the sense that there's really a focus on that yet?
I found it interesting when I went to Indonesia that people were thinking and talking often about global warming. Lots of people I met in rural villages were speaking about it because it directly affected their lives. A strawberry farmer I met, I mean, strawberries grow in a certain season, and he said in the last 2 years the dry and wet seasons have been mixed, which is not really working for his strawberries.
Hmm.
So that's just one example, but because some people in many parts of the world are, their livelihoods depend on these crops, and I mean, the food security in general that we have depends on the climate to an important extent.
Right.
But what I found was that most people don't know the connection between industrial agriculture and global warming. They don't know the details of it, and people sort of associate it mostly with industry mm-hmm. in general or the transport that happens, but there isn't as yet enough awareness of how the diet affects climate change and relatedly how important it is to reduce meat consumption.
Sonia, can you let our listeners know where they can go to learn more about your book, Project Animal Farm?
Absolutely. The book is available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, And I update my website often with content and my Twitter page as well. Readers can find me at www.soniafaruqi.com or on Twitter at @Sonia_Faruqi. I also love hearing from people. So once you read the book, I'd love to know what you think, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as well over email or over the phone.
We've been talking with Sonia Faruqi, author of Project Animal Farm, An Accidental Journey into the Secret World of Farming and the Truth About Our Food. Thanks a lot for being with us, Sonia.
Thank you so much, Tom and Greg.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. The Vegetarian Society is having a dinner and a movie on Saturday, July the 18th. We'll be showing the film Cowspiracy, which is about why environmental groups hesitate to talk about vegetarianism. You'll find reservation information at our website, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Lenny.
And I'm Greg Lawson.
For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Otherwise, could be human crime. Closer comes the screaming night. This beautiful creature must die. This beautiful creature must die. A death for no reason, a death for no reason is murder. And the flesh is so fried is not succulent, taste to your kind. It's death for no reason, and death for no reason is murder.